the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
I'm Carl Wilde, and you're listening to the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
Okay, welcome to the latest episode of the Sports Coaching Podcast with me, Sam Holmshaw. As always, we hope everyone is well in these recurring strange and difficult times. Absolutely delighted to welcome Carl Wilde onto the podcast this morning. Carl, how are you?
I'm really well, thanks, mate. Yourself?
Yeah, not too bad. How's everything been in this crazy time for us all? Have you managed to cope okay? How's it affected your coaching?
Yeah, obviously, like everyone else, it's just getting used to it, isn't it? We're lucky enough to be back in now, so we've been back in for just over a month. So it has obviously affected how we do things, but I think everyone's just sort of getting used to it now. And I hate to say it's going a little bit of the norm. So we've adapted and coped. So it's good just to get back on the pitch and that. So
yeah, absolutely. Realises how lucky we are, doesn't it, as coaches? So Carl, I guess to start us off, do you want to give all our listeners a bit of an introduction about yourself and your coaching background, and I guess what's led you to where you are today?
Yeah, no problem. Brief history, started a little bit later in terms of my coaching, got involved late 20s, early 30s and that. And like quite a lot of people, just got involved in terms of grassroots. Son needed a coach for his team, so just stepped forward and had a go of it, like most people do. And then probably after about a year or two, just got the bug. So just started taking it a little bit more seriously, went and got a few more coaching qualifications with my badges and that. And then decided to try and give it a go in terms of career. So left my job, went back to university, got a degree, got some further qualifications in terms of my coaching and so forth. And then just started looking for paid opportunities. So my first venture was outside of grassroots was with Crewe Alexandra. So I was looking to get involved with that club. Obviously, the history and reputation I've got in terms of producing players. So I got involved in the girls' programme there, which was really enjoyable. And that sort of took me interest in terms of working with girls. So I moved over after that just to have a go at boys coaching as well. So I worked at Wigan Athletic Academy for a couple of years. Enjoyed working there, but probably preferred the experience working in the girls' programme. So I went back to girls. So I went over to Stoke City, did a few years there, then eventually I've turned up at Manchester City now, where I work, in terms, again, within the girls' programme. So in terms, alongside that, got me teaching qualification as well. So started working at a college in terms of tutoring. And then from that, managed to get the opportunity where I'm at now. So I work at UCFB, which is a university primary that just looks after football courses, football degrees, so ranging from business and marketing, that type of stuff. But I look after the football coach management side of it down at the Etihad campus. And then alongside that, a few years ago, managed to get the opportunity to work at the FA as well in terms of tutoring on the level one and level two courses. So I'm still trying to do that at the moment. Obviously, it's a little bit difficult with the courses at the moment. But so they're my main three pathways at the moment. So I've got three different sort of roles in terms of football, which I enjoy. I like a bit of variety. So I need to be able to do different things. So I'm extremely lucky in terms of what I do. Extremely busy, which keeps me occupied, which is great. So that's primarily it, mate. Yep.
Yeah, really. Quite a well-varied background, actually. Really interesting to hear your coaching and what it seems to be a lecturing background as well. So if I could, Carl, let me ask you about your three roles. So first, tell us about UCFB. It's actually something I had a look at, must have been a good 5 years ago now. I had a look at the Burnley campus. So yep. Tell us a bit more about that, because it seems to be growing. You mentioned the Etihad campus, which I think has been around 2 or 3 years, if I'm right in thinking.
Yeah, just over 3 years now, yep. Yep, so when you first, Burnley was where it first started. So the concept, the idea behind it when it originated was to use these empty spaces, i.e. stadiums in the week when we're not being used. They recognised, the people who started it off recognised that they could be utilised. So they started using like executive boxes and so forth and the conference rooms that are available at a stadium, which was Burnley to start off with. and then use that and use the contacts all around within the club that they could use for guest speakers and lectures and so forth. So that was the concept. And obviously it just took off really, really quickly. So Burnley was just probably a little bit too small to then be able to cope with the demand. So they've opened up two campuses since then. So we've got one down at Wembley. So we use, again, the Wembley Stadium. And then obviously the one where I'm at is the Etihad Stadium with Manchester City. So again, we just use the space there. So that's mainly for the businessy side part of it. And then obviously the coaching side, I predominantly work in. There's other facilities around Manchester that we use. We try and link up with semi-professional clubs as well. So we've got some links with SC United and we've got some links with Curzon Ashton as well. So we can use their facilities and their pitches and so forth. And then that gives the chance for the students to get placements as well. So they can go do some work around these local clubs as well, in terms, again, whether it's media side or journalism side, or again, ourselves just on the coaching side. So degrees and then masters as well, if they want to go and do a masters in terms of it as well. So just trying to give them experience, knowledge around football and football coaching. And then hopefully the way we're looking at things and the way we see it at the moment is football coaching in terms of academies and so forth is looking more and more as a recognised career rather than just a part-time role in terms of what people are going to do as an extra. So it's probably looking like, I think some clubs already asked for it in terms of wanted degrees as qualifications now, not just coaching qualifications. You know yourself, it's not just knowledge around football, it's knowledge around how kids learn and how they develop and how they grow and what their needs are. So we don't always get that with specific coaching qualifications. So we're hopefully giving them that side in terms of the academic side. And then hopefully we then give them the opportunity to then go in and apply it on the pitch as well. So hopefully give them an all-round knowledge base, an all-round knowledge qualification that they can then go and use in terms of applying for jobs with clubs and so forth. So, yeah, it's a real good opportunity for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a great concept, and I think that's a really interesting point you make as well. Actually, that, you know, clubs are now looking for coaches not only to have the badges as such, but that academic route as well. And like you say, yeah, knowing about optimizing learning design, for example, or, you know, having an understanding of age and stage of development. So, you know, for you, is that really going to help benefit the game in future, in the years to come?
Yeah, I'd like to think so. For me, it's a massive part of coaching in terms of, I mention it to my students a lot, in terms of everyone can come out with a coaching qualification in terms of a coaching badge, in terms of whether it's a UEFA B, UEFA A, whatever it may be. But for me, when we're looking for coaches, especially in the environment where we're working at, we're looking more at the person rather than the coach in terms of their knowledge around football. Because, again, there's a lot of knowledgeable people out there. So it's what you're going to do extra. And like I said, the key bit is the actual people skills and so forth. And hopefully understanding how children learn and understanding what children think and how they develop and what their needs are in particular different stages of the development and so forth that we try and get across in terms of the modules that we deliver. I think that's more probably important than just an actual coaching qualification. I think clubs are recognising that now themselves, and you can get that environment right, you're just going to help kids develop better. So I think it's a key thing going forward for us.
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely agree with you there. And I think you make some great points. If I can ask you more about your role with Manchester City. So you're the foundation lead, phase lead, sorry, and under 12s coach of the Girls Regional Talent Club. So Tell us a bit more about that, and tell us, I guess, what girls football now is looking like from a youth development sort of structure as such.
Yeah. So first of all, in terms of my role, so I'm predominantly I work with the under 12s. So it's myself and another coach, and it's a nice system there. So we don't have a lead coach or an assistant coach. We just have two coaches for each age group. For those who don't really know the girls' program, some clubs do it in different ways. So at the moment, we run dual age bands. So the under 12s is under 12s, under 11s. And then we have an under 10s, which also is under 9s. So we have around about half and half in terms of the squad, in terms of age groups, and then that carries on all the way up to 16. So then from about this, like a development squad, some will run it as single age bands in terms of they'll have 9s, 10s, 11s and 12s and so forth. But at the moment, we're just doing the dual one. So I look after the 10s and 12s, and then hopefully there's going to be like a development team or an under-8s team coming on board with that soon as well. So we'll be looking after that. So predominantly my role there is just to help development of the players and also the development of the coaches in terms of creating the right environment for them. And then in terms of what we do, we've got a couple of sessions a week. Well, what we normally run is a couple of sessions a week and then a fixture as well. And the FA put in a couple of years ago that ideally, you don't have to, but ideally those age groups that we work with in the foundation phase plays against boys teams. So all our fixtures usually are against boys grassroots teams. I mean, occasionally we'll play other RTCs in terms of a girls programme. So again, lucky where we are, we don't actually enter a league. We just invite clubs in each week. So every Wednesday, we'll have a local grassroots team come in and we'll just play them in a fixture, which is great. Great environment just for them to come in, for the lads to come and experience the academy at Manchester City. So it's great for them. And it's great for us. We can control the environment and we can change the game in terms of how we want it to play, in terms of length, and maybe just put some extra conditions in the game if we want to, occasionally, because it's something that we can control. So that's really good. And then, like I say, two training sessions. And then last season, we also introduced futsal once a week because we thought it'd be really beneficial for the girls. Again, there's been loads of stuff around futsal at the moment in terms of why they should do it and so forth. We've got our own reasons why we've introduced it, which I'll touch upon a little bit later on. And then that's just a fixture program. So they're just fixtures on a Friday. And the full process behind part of that is we just let the girls go and play. So there's no coaching. There's no managing from the sidelines or anything. They get on, they turn up, they play. We just let them play. Come half-time, brief chat, how they're getting on, making sure they're all okay. If so, they go and play the second half and that's it. So there's no coaching around it. Just trying to strip it back to them just playing, enjoying football without any coaching, any pressure, anything at all. So that's gone quite well last season. So once again, everything's settled down here, we'll be looking to carry on that with this season as well.
Yeah, I think that sounds fantastic. You can see, hearing from what you're just saying there, your clear focus is on player development, and I think that's absolutely brilliant. So, you know, if I could just finally, before we move on to today's topic, if you just tell us a bit more about tutoring on the FA, because I'd be really interested to hear a bit more about what your role's about and what that entails.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically just tutor on the level one course and also the level two course. So it's something I wanted to get involved in terms of, once I'd settled down in my other roles in terms of me lecturing and me coaching, I wanted to give back a little bit in terms of grassroots. I recognise how much hard work goes on there in terms of the amount of hours it takes to actually look after a team with no, obviously, wages. You're just volunteering. So the amount of time they give up, I think, is fantastic. And I thought, if there's any support I can give, and obviously I wanted to do that. So initially, I did get involved in a mentoring programme at the FA as well. That's where we just go out and visit coaches and so forth and support them in their environment. And then from that as well, also started with the tutoring as well. So tutoring, especially level one, I think it's just an amazing course. It's just that introduction in terms of maybe what type of coaching sessions you can put on and how they can develop themselves and produce themselves. It's stripped away from the old course where basically said, here's a load of course, a load of sessions, yeah, take them away and go and deliver them. Yeah. It's more about, now here's some ideas, but then they have to go and come up with their own ideas, and we give them the reasons behind the type of practices that they should try and do. So again, predominantly most come in working with young kids anyways. It's usually the sort of foundation-y phase coaches that come in, because that's their first step into it. So again, we just try and get them to do loads of game-based stuff, loads of directional stuff, loads of competition in terms of scoring systems and so forth, and try and get them more about thinking about getting the kids just playing in sort of an environment and letting them make the decisions. So a word I try and use a lot in terms of my tutoring is freedom. Just let them have freedom. So don't tell them where they've got to pass the ball and where they've got to run to afterwards. So that sort of old drill type of stuff. And again, there's a lot of emphasis on creativity from the coaches in terms of type of practices to put on, And then creativity in terms of the players, can they be creative within the practices then? And then that player-centered approach in terms of Q&A, trying to get them to come up with the answers, trying to get them to come up with the solutions rather than just giving it to them. So a lot of my work is with the level one courses, which we really enjoy. And then the level two is just for those ones we want to go and do a little bit more knowledge around probably football and around about coaching. So it's a little bit mixture of half the course is roughly about, again, who the kids are, what they need and what type of development they need. So like the four corner approach in terms of the physical corner and so forth. And then also in terms of how they develop in terms of physically and so forth. So, and then alongside that, some technical information around football as well, just to give them a little bit more knowledge around the type of stuff maybe they need to support the players with as well. So yeah, something I really enjoy and hopefully can carry on doing once things get back to a little bit of normality.
Yeah, fantastic. You know, and I have to say as well, I did do that old level one course. And like you say, it was very, here's the drills, you go out and do them.
Yeah.
And I can remember getting to uni and thinking, well, that's not really taught me how to be a coach. And I was quite critical in the early days of, you know, the FA's coaching courses. But I have to say, you know, in the last few months when I've heard people like yourself talk about it, it sounds so much more appropriate, should we say, particularly when we're, you know, teaching these young coaches to go and optimise player development and such. And
the Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
And that brings us on nicely to our topic today, which is entitled Optimising Player Development Within the Foundation Phase in Football, which is obviously something, Carl, that we've got you on today because it really represents your experience and what you're doing at the minute. So, you know, if we jump straight into it, into our first segment, Carl, I think I would ask you, when we talk about player development or youth development, it's a term that's often, I think, thrown around a lot and probably has a lot of different meanings to different people. So, you know, when I say what is player development, what would that mean to you, Carl?
So there's a few words I'd probably use. I think, especially when you're working in the foundation phase, the first thing you've got to think about is that long-term approach in terms of development. So I always speak to coaches and I always speak to players and parents and so forth. When we're trying to develop players, we're trying to develop them for when they're 16, 17, 18, 19 years of age. We're not trying to develop them straight away for the next week or for the next game or whatever it'll be. So it's very much a long-term approach. So we've got, especially in terms of the 10s and 12s where we're working at the moment, we've got to provide them tools so that when they get to 14, 15 years of age and are moving up through the different age groups, they have different options in terms of the problems that they come across. So, for instance, if we just get players who are really good passers, when they come up to certain issues in the game or certain problems or certain situations, they will always go to that passing solution to get out of the situation or to go forward or whatever. But obviously, we want them to be able to have different options in that situation. So in terms of, can they dribble? Can they turn? Can they drive, stroke, run with the ball? Can they pass, but different types of passing and so forth? So the very first part of it is giving them all those different tools. And then later on, so we start then touching upon, little as they get a little bit older in the foundation phases, decision making around those tools then. So when's the best time to pass and when's the best time to dribble and so forth. But that's very, very minimal in terms of that actual development. Once they get into the youth development phase, then they can start getting really involved in the tactical side and so forth. But it's our job to be able to pass on to the coaches in that youth development phase, pass on players who've got everything that they need to then go deal with the tactical side of it. So that first approach for me is very much long-term in terms of player development. I've also got a massive thing on terms of, it's not just player development, it's person development. So in terms of, it's huge amounts on the type of person that we produce in these academies as well. It's not just about football. So we have a lot of emphasis on about them being decent people. So in terms of how they can help each other and how they can help coaches, how they can help visitors come in to the environment when they see them and so forth. The type of person you are in terms of how do you react to different situations, again, whether that's football related or non-football related. We have a big emphasis on just trying to have some sort of understanding of each of our players. We need to know where they come from. So we need to know what they've been doing on at school. So if we put that in the grassroots situation, one of the things we talk about in terms of on the courses is you'll have players who are late sometimes, you'll have parents who are late sometimes for training, and automatically we'll jump and think, you know, you're late again, you're late, so you're not starting, or you're going to have to go and do this now. But you have no idea what's happened previously in terms of that. You don't know in terms of, for example, the parent might finish work at 5 o'clock and been running around madly just to get them there for half five, and if they're 5 minutes late, does it really matter? And again, it's not the player's fault either.
Yeah.
So again, it's nobody's fault. It's just how it is in terms of their other issues that have got on in life. So I think you really need to understand people before you can just go and try and judge them and so forth. And then just maybe what we can do then to support them and help them. And then that goes back to that personal development. So I've got a huge thing around, again, we talk about going back to that coaches, about people and people skills. We want the right coaches in, not just in terms of football knowledge, but in terms of people skills as well. And then that hopefully transfers onto the players as well in terms of the skills that they produce. So development around, like I say, long-term development around people. And then development, I think, just in terms of sport, just overall sport, we can encourage all the players to play as many different sports as they can. We encourage, in terms of just that long-term approach again, in terms of just enjoying sport and getting involved, physical activity and so forth. So can we develop them physically in terms of having different attributes that you can transfer over to football maybe later on in life? So that love for the game and love for sport's really key. And then it's got enjoyment, because again, if you don't enjoy it, and I don't think if you don't enjoy it as a coach, the experience is not as good. And if they don't enjoy it in terms of players, again, they're not going to optimise their learning. They're not going to optimise their development. They might not even stay in the sport. So in terms of player development, they're the four key areas for me. And then hopefully from that, you'll start producing players that are reaching their potential 10, 12 years down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of things I wrote down, if I get my English correct, while you were talking there, Carl. I really like how you first said long-term approach. I think that's something that, you know, I know myself being in youth development, you do often forget that, and particularly if you've got some really talented young players and you're playing on a Sunday, and then that desire to win can sometimes get to you a bit. And I think that is... It's such a great point, thinking about youth development. You're not thinking so much about what we're going to look like at the end of this season, or we've got to get them to this, even though that's on your mind. Like you say, you're trying to develop the best player when they get to 17, 18, 19 and really look to potentially move on to a professional club if possible. So I think that's a really good point that I myself would again associate with, you know, player development. But
yep.
I like how you mentioned that there's a big focus on person development. I think in the past, you know, academies were criticised a lot for demanding a lot of time at academies, you know, I think 5, 6, 7 times a week for some football academies. And, you know, one thing that I felt when I was a youngster that was missed in coaching was there was so much focus on player development, but hardly any on actually developing you as a person. And I mean, I can remember thinking as a young player myself, I never felt a coach was interested in me as a person. It was more just interested in my skills. So I think that is, I think that's really interesting. And, you know, I posed a question to you. It sounded like you're developing life skills with these young girls as well. You know, so if they don't make it, they've got a lot of life skills and a lot of good things come from the academy anyway. So, you know, in your opinion, how important is that, would you say?
I think it's really important, because again, most people will play football for enjoyment and in terms of recreational rather than get a career out of it in terms of get a professional contract. So that's whether they're in grassroots or whether that's in an academy environment at the moment. Again, if you look at the research, the percentages that actually go and make it on a professional footballer are something like 0.001%, something crazy like that. So surely the emphasis then for that, in terms of that, is we're just getting producing players or producing people for just playing it in terms of recreational. So therefore, can we then produce skills that they can then go use in different elements of their life as well? It's not just about football. So I think it's massively important. And I think it's just, again, if we can help them in certain aspects of football in terms of social skills and psychological skills, that stuff they can then go transfer into other elements of their life. So in terms of, if you talk about confidence and self-esteem, So confidence and self-esteem in terms of being on the ball and being positive on the ball, but then confidence and self-esteem to be able to stand up in front of someone and do the team talk at half time. So an 8-year-old or 9-year-old going, here you go, you're going to tell us what we need to do in the next period, or to ask the players what they think and so forth. For a child to be able to go and do that, that's huge for them. And then they can go and do that in school, and they can go and do that in college and university when they get older, and they can have that confidence and self-esteem to go and do it in the career, whatever career they end up doing and so forth. So again, just small examples like that. I think if we can help them do that, then I think that's an amazing thing for to help that child. But I think on the flip side as well, in terms of football, I think it helps them in football as well. In terms, if you can get some of that confidence and that self-esteem, that surely they're going to be a better player on the pitch. If you can get them to become problem solvers, if you can get them to become, make them turn into decision makers and so forth, they're going to be better players on the pitch. If you can get them to be decent and help each other in terms of that teamwork effort, in terms of better communication and so forth, it's going to help them on the pitch. So it's a two-way process with it in terms of, yeah, you are trying to make them better people, but the result also comes out, they're going to become better footballers as well. So it's a win-win situation for me. And in terms of just going back to that, you mentioned about the game day and so forth, in terms of you've got good players and you can't help but go and win. I fully understand that. And so we try and approach it. And again, when I talk to new coaches and so forth, I try and get them to think about game day is not a match. It's just an extension of training.
I like that.
Because it is just another opportunity for them to go and learn and to go and develop. So the game's just a training session. Yeah. So we try and link match day or game day, whatever you want to call it, to the previous training session. So if we're doing a session on dribbling, and the focus and the game's on dribbling, in terms of this is what we want you to try and do in the game, can you try and get past whatever it may be? And the team talk's not necessarily then at halftime about what's just happened in that period. It'll go back to in terms of that link or that focus in terms of dribbling. Yeah. And that's all it is about. We say, don't get me wrong, kids want to go and play football and they want to go and win it. And they want to go and win a match. That's part of football, isn't it? That's part of the competition. But the big difference is they come off the pitch, if they've lost, within about 2 minutes, it's forgotten about. Because they're going to talk to the mates again, and they go home and they go and play PlayStation, or they go out and they go out to the mates and go play football again in the park, wherever it may be. So I understand that, you know, we don't want to take that competition away from it because that's part of football. But at the same time, it's not the important element of it in terms of, if you can approach it as an extension of training, as another opportunity to learn, then I think it helps coaches massively.
Yeah, and I think obviously people sometimes criticise that approach, saying, well, you're not making competitive players. But at the same time, you take a step back, yeah, but they're 7 years old, they're 8 years old, 9 year olds, 10 year olds. Did he need that amount of pressure on them at such a young age, when it doesn't really matter, like you say? And I think that, again, I think that's such a great point. And I really like that extension of training. And I often think, you know, sometimes, like you say, when you're speaking to these other coaches that you're working with, and sometimes from a coaching perspective, if you're almost changing the perception of that game, then I do think as a coach sometimes as well, that helps you sit back and go, oh, actually, we're just trying to meet our longer term goals as such. So,
absolutely.
I think they're really great points. And if I could just ask you about, you know, so you mentioned you encourage different sports, participation in different sports, and you mentioned the word transfer. So, you know, again, from your experience, why is that so important, particularly in this foundation phase as such?
I think, first of all, it's just in terms of, we're presuming again that when we've got a 7 or 8 year old playing football, that's that all they're going to play for the rest of their lives for some reason. And again, they're experiencing at the moment, so that's great and they're liking it at the moment, but in 5 years' time, they might not enjoy it anymore, or in 5 years' time, they might actually go and find another sport that they enjoy, which, again, this is absolutely fine. That's not an issue at all. They're still physically active, which is fantastic. They're still enjoying whatever they're doing. So we've just got to be mindful of that. So they should be experimenting with other sports. They should be trying out other sports, A, just to find out whether they might actually enjoy it and prefer it to football, or whether they can do it alongside football. So I think that's really key, first of all. Just, again, we shouldn't just be thinking, right, this is it, this is what we're going to do for the rest of our lives. And I think after that, there's just so many benefits to it as well, in terms of those transferable skills usually come from the physical element of the game. So in terms of, and if we look at basketball or rugby, in terms of how they travel with the ball and how they travel past players in those sports, it's transferable in terms of what we're doing in football. So the change of speed, the acceleration, the deacceleration, the stopping and the starting, the twisting and the turning and so forth, all that they do can then be transferred into football. So if they can go away and do that on another night when we're not doing football, and again, we're not getting overloaded with football and we're trying something new, that's fantastic. And they could actually learn something that we do within those sports. Most sports, especially when it comes to team sports, they're usually even the same concepts, and they're like usually invasion games. So there's usually a lot of transferable stuff, even away from the physical side, in terms of the tactical side. Again, if you think about it, you go back like a game of hockey, the principle of hockey is exactly the same as the principles of football. Yeah. So they can still learn the decision-making around it and so forth. They won't realise they're doing it, but it will benefit them, again, as they move along over the years in terms of their development. So I think that's it. And the biggest one, though, for me is just because they are still kids, so why limit them to one sport? Go and try as many different sports as you can, many physical activities as you can, and just go and enjoy it. Yeah. And it can only be beneficial for them.
Absolutely. And you make some really great points there, actually. You know, I think about tactical viewpoint, like you say, invasion games is basically exactly the same tactical concept, although the rules are slightly different, but very similar tactical performance problems as such. Yeah. So, you know, if we're creating young problem solvers, then surely that helps. And, you know, from a technical point of view, I always think of the example of Zlatan Ibrahimovic, who I believe it was a black belt in Taekwondo or something of mixed martial arts nature. Yeah. And you see the solutions he performs when he's shooting out of this world. And, you know, I know myself, I was a swimmer as a youngster, only swam 7 times a week. And ultimately that limited my, you know, ability in other sports as well. So I think that's really important and really interesting as well.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
So, you know, if we move on, and I guess if I could ask you, you know, just a bit more about that foundation phase, just out of my own interest. So we spoke about the training focus as such. So, you know, physical training, I think physical training, particularly for the grassroots coaches, something that sometimes is probably placed more importance than actually needed. So, you know, what do you do physical training? If you do, how do you incorporate that? Is that a big focus for you at the foundation age?
Yeah, we do. So we do probably around about 15 minutes before every session. So there's some sort of physical development. But again, it's just play. Yeah. So usually the biggest or the most common thing that we do in terms of the physical is tag. And then we just change the rules around the game of tag. Because again, we're just trying to incorporate those fundamental physical requirements, obviously, which is the agility, balance, coordination, and speed. So we can usually get one of them or more than one of them out of a game of tag, depending on how we actually format that actual game of tag. So for instance, if it's just a normal game of tag, you still want to get the agility and the speed and so forth. But then if we just introduce, I don't know, maybe we put some cones down. So there's a number of cones around the area. And then to actually get a point, you have to either touch a cone or turn it over. So they're usually doing that while they're running at speed. So to be able to do that, you're going to have really good balance. So if you look at your Messi, in terms of how he dribbles and how he gets, in terms of weaving in and out and how he's getting people trying to get the ball off of him, a lot of it that down to the balance that he has. So he has an amazing balance. He has amazing core in terms of being able to do that. So if we can get him to sort of mimic those sort of movements and those skills, you can do so in a game of tag. Like I say, if they're running along and then trying to flip a cone over or touch a cone at speed, and obviously having to lean down. So that's just down to balance. Or we might do in terms of if we want to get a bit more speed out of it, we just make the area bigger. Yeah. So in terms of it's less twisting and turning, it's more just straight line sprinting because they can just run further to get away from the person chasing them. Yeah. If you want more agility in terms of twisting and turning, we change it from a square and just do a triangle because then it's less area and it's harder to get out the corners. So the three angles of a triangle are obviously a lot more difficult to escape from than a corner of a square. So you just adapt it and change it, but it's usually just play.
Yeah.
So it's not a physical program in terms of straight line running or any terms of those sort of drills. It's just play. And again, they won't know we're developing. They just turn up and think we're just going to play for 10, 15 minutes at the start of each session.
Yeah.
But it's carefully planned to make sure certain outcomes are coming from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's often a misperception as such that, you know, grassroots coaches I know particularly or I've worked with tend to think, like you say, you have to do them running drills or sprinting drills for fitness, whereas actually, you know, fun games for 10, 15 minutes at the start of a session is such a great way, like you say, doing it without them actually realizing they're working on them skills. And, you know, as well, I always think sometimes that really helps to not get rid of the silliness, if you know what I mean, but then it helps them focus on the actual football skills as well afterwards. Yeah. So I think that's a really brilliant example as such, actually. So what you implement there. And, you know, that really links on to this idea of rough and tumble play that I'm really looking forward to asking you about. So, you know, you shared with me an online webinar where you spoke about that before. I think it was just in the summer. And I was really interested in this idea of rough and tumble play. So if you could, Carl, just give us an overview of that and how you implement it within your own role.
Yep. So basically, rough and tumble play is what it says in terms of it's when more than one child engage in sort of high intensity physical activity in terms of there's usually some sort of contact between the people involved in it. So probably the best example of it is anyone who's obviously involved in coaching or just involved with small children. Usually at some stage you'll see a couple of usually boys, and this we'll go on to that in a minute, it's usually boys involved in it, are just wrestling or chasing each other or trying to take something off one another. And that basically is what rough and tumble play is. It's that sort of physical activity that takes place. And then it's the benefits of it, it's twofold in terms of the first one that people don't always think about is the social aspect of it. So the social aspect is that usually when they're involved in this, there's some sort of, they've made up some sort of game or they've made up some sort of rules around it. So in terms of if it's that chasing one and attack, if I tag you, you've then got to chase me, or if I get the water bottle off. Again, we don't sit down and plan it, but some communication's gone in between the two of them, or it's just naturally evolved between them. So that social aspect in terms of actually being able to do that between the two is quite key in terms of their development. And then obviously the biggest one is obviously the physical outcomes that you get from it in terms of there's a lot of chasing. So again, there's a lot of running, there's a lot of stopping, there's a lot of accelerating and de-accelerating. And then there's a lot of strength work in it as well. Because again, you'll see it if a child's got, I don't know, they've got hold of a ball or they've got hold of this water bottle and the other child wants it, quite often they hide it underneath them. So they might lie on the ground and just look after it. And then the other one's trying to lift them up and then grab it off them. So there's loads of benefits from it in terms of actual physical development. So again, research has just shown that it is mainly boys that get involved in this sort of play. So in terms of our program, we identified it over the last year or two that it's something that the girls needed in terms of their physical development. It's just because, again, I don't never want to stereotype and say girls do this and boys do that. That's not the case. Everyone's individual and everyone's different. Yeah. We have some girls who did engage in it.
Yeah.
In terms of because of their backgrounds, maybe it was, I don't know, because of the family background in terms of the other brothers or they were the youngest or the old, whatever it may be. We had some girls who actually just outside the environment involved in boxing and so forth. So they were quite used to it. So they were involved in it anyway. But the large proportion of the girls didn't get involved in it. And research shows that girls do prefer or are more comfortable playing on their own. So they're quite happy off going doing individual stuff, whereas boys usually like to be in a group or with somebody else. And the other thing is we don't encourage it with girls. It's not something as adults we do. Again, whether it's just due to history and so forth, that it's just something that girls shouldn't do. It's not very appropriate for girls. So again, there's loads of reasons why we don't do it. So it's just something that we recognise, again, just in terms of their physical development, in terms of because we've got to look at football, it is a physical sport. There is contact within it, so it is a requirement. So can we incorporate this rough and tumble play in a safe environment and incorporate it as part of their physical development. Again, without them knowing, it just becomes part of their playing. And then hopefully we'll get the benefits of that in terms of how they then go and play the game, especially because they play boys in the fixtures. And when they again get a little bit older in terms of when the games become a little bit more competitive, so hopefully that will help them physically in terms of coping with those physical demands of the game.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant overview. And the word that almost jumps out to me there is, it's almost like a bit of chaos, isn't it, at times? And I think we've, as coaches, sometimes we're brought up to kind of reject chaos and everything has to look like a typical session and organised and, you know, not so much contact and everyone being nice and such. And not saying that rough and tumble isn't nice, by the way, but I think that sometimes engaging in a bit of chaos is so beneficial for youth development. We're not constraining players as such. We're literally allowing them to be problem solvers as such. You know, that's the aim of it, would you say?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. It's a massive part of foundation phase in terms of it should be chaos. It is play. I think coaches struggle in terms of when there is chaos going in front of them. I think people then think that it's not working how it should be working. If people are standing behind, it's usually parents or other coaches, wherever it may be, and you look over and there is chaos, they think the session's not going well. Yet the amount of learning that's going on within that chaos is unbelievable. It's just making sure that we've planned for the chaos and there's certain outcomes coming from that chaos. And as long as that's happening, then that's absolutely fine. I always speak to coaches about justifications. So you've got to justify what you're doing. And if you justify with this is what the outcome is going to be, and then if I'm looking within that and I can see that outcome occurring, then it's happy days. And that's exactly what it is. So, yeah, that's why we again talked about that freedom.
Yeah.
That freedom comes within it. It's just having that controlled freedom. So if you link it back to schools, I talk about when kids in primary school, when they do painting, usually when they do painting, they're allowed to go and do whatever they want and paint and be creative and so forth. But that environment where they paint is controlled. So the teacher tells them when they can go and get the paint. They sit in a certain position so it doesn't go, and they put the overalls on and so forth, and the tables are covered. And then once all that's done, then off you go and be creative and do what you want. It's controlled creativity in terms of a little bit of safety aspect and in terms of just that preparation. The teachers, a lot of preparation, but then it's down to the kids just being creative and doing what they want to do. It's the same with coaching. Do your planning in terms of making sure you know what you want to get out of the session, but then just let it go and let them just go and learn in that environment. What do you want to do? Because they're kids, they just want to go and play. So let them play and the learning will take place within it.
Absolutely. You know, again, some really great points. And, you know, what I think the conversation is really leaning towards is this idea on an emphasis on play sometimes over that idea of blocked, unopposed technical practice. So the technical development as such is, you know, happening in this play and in this environment, particularly when you're working with the ball. So, you know, why is that important in the foundation phase? And I know the FA have done a lot of work to kind of change that perception in the last 4 or 5 years, but traditionally that was, you know, particularly when I come through, it was all technical, unopposed practice. We were never really thrown into, go on, you just go and play a couple of small-sided games, for example, or anything. So, you know, why is that important, particularly at this phase in particular?
So, numerous reasons. I think there's some that obviously are beneficial for everyone, and then there's other things that I think are beneficial as well that I've sort of introduced myself and the reasons behind it. So the first one is obviously it's just the fun part element again and playing it. They're going to enjoy it. They're going to enjoy it more if they're in that competitive environment rather than just standing there passing the ball between them and a mate, that they get bored and they lose concentration really, really quickly. So there's that motivational factor, first of all. The second one, you get more outcomes out of it. So if there is opposition or if there is movement and so forth, there's decision-making then to go with it. So in terms of if I'm passing in a game, I'm going to have to make the decision of who to pass to, when to pass to them, where to pass it, what part of the foot am I going to use, where exactly am I going to pass the ball, and numerous other reasons. Whereas if I'm passing to me and a mate who are stuck on a cone, then there's no decision-making whatsoever. Once I get the ball, I'm just going to give it him or her back, and that's it. I haven't got to make any decisions about where I'm going to pass it to because they're going to be in the same place where they were before. I'm probably going to use the same part of my foot because of the angle of the pass. I'm going to use the same amount of weight because that's, again, it's going to get there over the same distance. There's no decision-making whatsoever. And then on top of that, in terms of it just pushes them a little bit in terms of a development, it's quite easy to do stuff unopposed. And there's argument that sometimes they need that, especially if they're new to the sport. But eventually they are going to go into a game. So even if they come to training for the first time ever, at the end of that training session, they're going to be put in a game. And then at the end of the week, they're going to be put in a game. So we're not preparing them for that game if we're putting them in an unopposed situation where they're going, yeah, it's great, yes, I can do this. And all of a sudden they get put into a competitive game and they're not prepared for it because of what we've done previously. So I can understand why there's that argument trying to give them a little bit of confidence to start off with, but we're not really helping to prepare them for it. And then the other thing for me is, especially this day and age, as coaches, we always want to spend more time with our players on the pitch because it's quite often only an hour a week or it's only 2 hours, whatever it may be. So a huge one is let's make the most of that time then. Yeah. So why do stuff that they could do away from training? We've got 10 players or 12 players or whatever. So let's make the most of having 10 or 12 players. Let's put them in 2v2s. Let's put them in 3v3s. Let's put them in 1v1s, whatever it may be. If they want to then go learn a certain skill, so for example, like a Cruyff turn or whatever, this day and age, we can just go and look at a YouTube clip or we can go whatever it may be and I can learn that and I can go do that in my back garden. So that might be homework that we set. So we said, this week, go away and do the Cruyff turn and come in training and use that within the next session. I don't need to spend 10, 15 minutes showing it you and going through practicing it. You can do that at home. Let's make the most of having other people with us in this environment and let's go and get as close to the game as we can in terms of decision-making and competitiveness and opposition and let's do that for an hour instead.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's that traditional idea on decision-making is that, you know, you've got the technical skill, you know, here's the tactic, off you go. It's really, it doesn't actually work like that. You know, players... They need to be experienced in making these decisions in training to then replicate that into the game. You know, it must represent the training environment must represent the playing environment, you know, exactly what you're saying there. And I think, like you say, that's, you know, you talk about the Cruyff turn there. I think that's absolutely brilliant. You know, I was speaking to a chap called Ben Bell on the podcast last week and he mentioned the Cruyff turn and he said, you know, coaches tend to get young players into a drill for 20 minutes and saying, right, you know, dribble around, stop, here's a Cruyff turn, look how I do it, perform it exactly the same. And the problem is the Cruyff turn was invented to solve a particular problem of getting back to the player. So if we're then just going, go on then, copy that and then put it in the game, well, they're not learning how to use that to solve a problem. It was like you say, you know, looking at YouTube, which I actually never really thought about, that's such a great example. Have a look at that, practice it at home, see how to use it, get a feel for it, come up with it yourself, and then let's see if you can implement it in training. Yeah. I think that's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, to me, it goes back to that problem solving. You know, we're trying to create problem solvers, not prescribing the solution for them, would you say?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Because again, in terms of if we put them in, so I talk about if we do 1v1s, we never show them a particular skill how to get past one in 1v1. It's a problem they have to come up with. So you need to get to there. So that might be a gate or might be an area. And that person's going to try and stop you. Yeah. So you do what you want to do. You try and come up with something that's going to get you past that person and into that gate or through that gate and into that area. So you come up with different options that you have. So you work out a skill or think of a skill that you can do or whatever it may be. That's the problem. Go and solve it. And that's basically what we do in terms of most of our practices. So then it might be a two, it says two of you there, this is what you've got to do, and there they're going to try and stop you. Come up with solutions. And instead of saying, this is how you're going to do it. Because again, different things suit different people, especially in that foundation phase, because there'll be different levels of ability, there'll be different levels of terms of physical attributes, in terms of speed and agility and so forth. So what suits one player will not then go suit another player. Yeah. And that one solution they come up with there might not then work when you go and play against these two players on the next pitch.
Yeah,
because they've got different attributes to the two that you just come up against. And when you come play on a Saturday or Sunday, you don't know who you're going to come up against. So again, you need to have two or three different thing solutions so that when you come up against these different players, you can then choose which solution is the best one for that situation against that particular player. So it's no good just saying this is how you're going to do it, because it's not that simple. If it was that simple, then we'd all be professional footballers.
Absolutely. And like you say, another great point of we're not all the same. Different physical characteristics, different anthropometric characteristics. So, you know, why were we traditionally taught to perform something exactly the same? Never made any sense to me.
The Sports Coaching Podcast with Sam Holmshaw.
But yeah, I'm a bit conscious of time and where we've spoken for a good 50 minutes already, Carl. So, you know, if we move on to, I always finish on the podcast, implications for coaching practice. So, you know, for all the coaches listening to this, how do they begin to optimize player development? So, you know, what would be your, you know, I guess, I don't know if tips is the right word or advice to implement some of these concepts that we've spoke about today into their practice, you know, to really begin to optimize that player development?
I think the biggest one for me, first of all, is planning. I don't think you can spend too much time planning. I appreciate people haven't always got the time to do it and so forth, but planning is massive for me. And then in terms of when you're doing that, always thinking about, would you enjoy it yourself? So if you were in that practice, would you enjoy it yourself? So if it's a yes, then fantastic. Does it look like the game in some sort of aspect? It doesn't have to be the full 11 side, but does it look like an aspect of the game? So things for me in terms of that are usually, is the direction within it. So is one team trying to go one way and one the other? Transition's massive in terms of, especially the game, the modern game. So if the other person wins it, what do they then go and do? So quite often a practice might just stop. Well, I've got a tackle, right, stop, we're going, and it starts again. Why? Yeah. If they win it, what do they then have to go and do? So transition's key for me as well. And I think a massive one for me is scoring systems as well. Scoring systems can be really beneficial. So I usually have more than one scoring system. So you get 1 point for if you achieve this, but you'll get 2 points if you manage to do this. So then it helps the different levels of players. So the ones who are a little bit less in terms of ability or confidence might be happy just go and get the 1 point and do that. The ones who need pushing a little bit in terms of their development because they're a little bit further down the road, they can go and achieve the 2 points. So, for example, if we're doing dribbling, we might say, well, you decide how many players you want to defend against you. If you have one defender and you get past them, that's a point. If you ask for two defenders and you get past them, that could be 3 or 4 points, whatever you want it to be. So, again, they get to choose the terms of level of difficulty and they get to choose the terms of the amount of points we try and win. And, again, it helps them in terms of those different levels. So just, again, things like that. And the other one I just say is keep it simple. As coaches, we try and come up with these crazy ideas in terms of sessions sometimes because we think that's the right thing to do in terms of they do this, then we do that, and then we do this. Again, it can waste time, unfortunately. So I always look to get the simplistic starting point in terms of just so the players can go and they're playing within a couple of seconds. And then we can just start introducing little progressions and making it more and more difficult as we go along. So it's just utilising that time that we have. And then finally, it's just that, again, that long-term approach. Don't try and fix what happened on Saturday or Sunday.
Yeah.
You've got to look, you've always got to look ahead and think, what would they need to be able to do in 10 years' time? And therefore, what can I do now that can help them? And just remember, I've got them for 10 years or 12, whatever it may be. I don't need to try and fix everything in 1 hour on a Thursday night. I've got how many of Thursday nights coming up over those 10 years. Let's just be patient with it. Be patient with the kids. Be patient with yourself, and it will all happen. So,
yeah, I really like that. I really like your first point of planning. You know, there's a lot of stuff out there. I see it a lot on Twitter about, oh, the game's the teacher. So, you know, just play the game and the game will teach them everything. Yeah, that's great. But, you know, you have to have some form of constraints, how you're going to manipulate the practice, you know, like you say, depending on what you want to achieve. So, you know, if you're wanting to work on scoring, you know, can we manipulate the game so it's affording more opportunities to get into those situations, for example? And I think that's often a message that's miscommunicated in a way. And I think a lot of coaches think, go on, then we'll just do 11 versus 11 for 20 minutes or whatever. And that's going to teach them all the solutions. And sometimes it's not as simple as that, is it? You actually do have to think about, well, what are the couple of rules I'm going to implement here
yeah.
on that long-term plan, like you say?
I think what I liked on that one is, like I say, you've got to have that focus. So the focus is on dribbling or the focus on passing, whatever it is. I try and say to coaches, you've got to make sure that if you focus on passing, for instance, the players are going to pass more than they would do in usually in a game.
Yeah.
So there's an emphasis on it. If it's going to be on dribbling, they need to be dribbling more than they would do so when they play the normal game. If it's shooting, again, they need to be doing more of it. So you've got to put rules in place or constraints in place or conditions that encourages or forces a little bit them to do that more often than they would do so. And then there's your focus. And then that's it then. They're practicing it because they're doing it more than they usually would do.
Yeah, absolutely. Really great point. And I think, like you say, it transitions as well, particularly for the football game. It is, I think, and you know, I've even done it myself this year. You sometimes focus that much on what we do in the attack phase and what we're going to do in the defensive phase. And like you say, transition is normally the one forgotten about. And then, you know, I can remember with the women's team I manage, we'd not really done too much on that. And then you're watching the game and they're just like, oh, what are we doing in between this phase? And I think, like you say, that kind of does link with problem solving as well. Almost probably, you could say, a really important part of problem solving. Right, we've suddenly won the ball. What do we do in this transition? Or we've suddenly lost it. But what do we do there? You know, you know. So I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
Yeah, again, it's key. Again, try not to overcomplicate it. The emphasis is we've still got to have that focus. So for example, the focus is on dribbling. But we've then also got to add something to it in terms of that transition as well. So I don't want to spend too much time on the transitional part because that's not my focus. My focus is on dribbling. But I've got to motivate that defender to defend correctly. And then I've also got to give a little bit of thought process around the person dribbling, what happens if I do lose the ball. Because if I tell the defender that if you win it, you've just got to give it to the attacker back, what motivation have I got to go and defend properly? None. If you win it and then you manage to get over the line that they were coming from, I'll give you a point. And then you can earn points as well while you're not the main emphasis in terms of the dribbling. And then in terms of you've lost it, can you go and win it back in terms of the person who started dribbling? Because if you win it back again, you can still go and get your point. So that basically is the game again. I don't want to be spending too much time on that transition because that's not my focus. But I've got to add it into my practice to make it as close to the game as possible. Yeah. I can do a session on transition. So we can do a session on after you've just won the ball or after you've just lost the ball. So that might be that counter press or in terms of counter attacking. So that's fine. I can do a session on that. But I'm just trying, again, in terms of practice, just make it as close to the game as I possibly can without playing the game.
Yeah. Like you say, being aware of
what
the game is and knowing that, like you say, well, that happens in a game, so let's try and implement as much as it into the practice. Another great point again, and you know, I think the final thing that I'd just like to say just before we finish it is again, you know, I like how you mentioned long-term, you know, long-term, it is so important. You know, we've obviously got seasonal goals, we've got macro, meso, micro goals as such.
Yeah.
But like you say, that thinking, they always say to us on the master's course, thinking 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years ahead, you know, with the core of that group, particularly if you are in these youth development settings, you know. So a final point, Carl, why is that so important?
I think because, first of all, of where they are in terms of age and so forth. So they're not adults yet, or they're not 16-year-old, they're not 14-year-old yet. So let them enjoy doing what they're doing at that age. So in terms of 7 or 8-year-olds, first of all, give them stuff and let them learn stuff in terms of what's relevant for a 7 or 8-year-old. So one of the reasons that we have small-sided games, so for instance, certain age groups play 5v5, certain age groups play 7v7 and so forth. Now, there's a lot of research around in terms of number of touches on the ball and so forth, and that's absolutely right and why we do it. But the other reason we do it is because that's all they can cope with at that age. So they can only cope with having 4 other teammates on the pitch, and they can only cope with having no offside. They can't. You put an offside rule in, they wouldn't understand it, and it'd put them off the game. So therefore, that's what they need at that age.
Yeah.
So give them stuff that they need in terms of development at that age. Don't try and give them stuff that they need to do when they're 12, 13, 14, etc.
Yeah.
And then the other thing for me is, whatever we do at this young age now, that's basically sort of moulding, developing the type of player you're going to get as they get older and older and older. So I used the example the other day in terms of when I was mentoring, we had a I was working with a coach, and he had a player who played at the back. And every time the ball came, he cleared it. As soon as it came, he got rid of it. He didn't want to keep hold of it because his thought process was, I'm playing at the back and I don't want to lose it because the opposition might go and score the goal. So the conversation with the coach was, if we don't do something around that now, that's going to be his experience of playing football for the next 20, 30 years. Yeah, as soon as the ball comes, I'm getting rid of it. Yeah. Now, for me, that's no experience of playing football. Yeah. That's a rubbish experience.
Yeah,
we play football because we want the ball and we want to go and do stuff with it.
Yeah.
So we've got to help him now. We've got to change his mentality, and else that's it for the rest of his life. Yeah. So we just did some, like, just for a half time, said for 10 minutes, the first 10 minutes, you've got to have at least 3 touches of the ball, at least 3, before you pass it on. Now, if the opposition go and score and nick it off you and go and score, that's my fault. Because I've told you, you've got to go and do that. So don't worry about that. All the players can hear it. It's my fault now if they go and score. After 10 minutes, we'll take that rule away and you can go and play the game as you normally would, or how you want to do, whatever you want to do. Because we don't want to really force it on him. So just keep doing that and keep doing that with him over a couple of games and then increase it and increase it. And eventually, I'm not saying he's always going to get it and dribble and get past the player, but he's got the confidence and he's got the tools now. But if he wants to, he'll take a couple of touches and then pass it on, which surely is a miles better experience than what he was having a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And that'll be him again now going forward for the rest of his footballing time. So it's key, it's called the foundation phase for a reason, in terms of we're giving them the foundations for the rest of their footballing time.
Yeah.
So we talk about houses, don't we, in terms of the foundations are there and that's what everything is. If the foundations aren't right, the house will fall down. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
So it's the same with the players, isn't it? If we don't get those foundations right in terms of giving them skills that they can probably only learn at that young age, then we're doing them a disservice.
Yeah.
You know, we're there to help them to become as best as they possibly can. So given the skills that we need now at that age.
Yeah. But Carl, I think that's absolutely brilliant. And what I love about that is, in your example there, you're playing the game on the match day as such, and you're saying directly to your centre-back in that case, let's constrain you and just have 3 touches. Brilliant. Not enough. I don't think enough do that in coaching, like you say, because it's an extension of your training. And I think just a final, you know, point and just a bit of advice from yourself, you know, when we're asking coaches to do this, sometimes there's always a bit of difficulty from the stakeholders in the environment, particularly junior football. Parents are often, you know, bigged up as a big problem in junior football. So, you know, in your role in foundation phase and such, how important is that communication with the parents and other stakeholders to understand what you're doing, and how would you go about that with a couple of tips?
Yeah, it's massive. And it's a really good point in terms of, they don't usually buy into it or understand it because they don't understand it. It's just down to education.
Yeah.
In terms of when I started, in terms of my journey, I didn't know all of it because I didn't know about it. It's as simple as that. So I've either got information myself through courses or reading or whatever it is. So obviously parents won't necessarily have that because they won't know anything about it, or they don't need to do anything about it. So I think first of all, in terms of getting that information out to them, and whether that's through a meeting and like a social meeting or whatever it may be, I think that's really key in terms of, this is why we're doing it. This is the why. We need to know the why. And this is the plan. So, you know, bear with me. It's going to take a long time, but this is the reason we're doing it, and so forth. And then get them involved more. So usually team talks before games or during sessions are done away from parents because we don't want them hearing what we're going to say. Yeah. Do it in front of them.
Yeah.
So, for instance, so the focus today during the game, I just want you to dribble. I want you to dribble all the time, as much as I can. Now, if I had not done that in front of the parents, as soon as they get the ball, some parents will be telling them to pass.
Yeah.
Pass the ball. But the coach just told me to dribble. So if you do it in front of the parents and they go, and these parents here and everyone behind you, every time you try and dribble past someone, they're going to give you loads of encouragement and they're going to praise you.
Yeah.
And no one's going to tell you to pass the ball today because your focus is on dribbling.
Yeah.
Now, you've done that in front of the parents, so they know that now and they can help you and support you.
Yeah.
And the vice versa, again, if you want on passing, so today's focus on passing. If you do a really good pass, you'll get a big round of applause, you get some encouragement from the parents and so forth. But unless they know that, how can they actually help you and support you? Yeah. They don't know that. They might go against you, not nastily, just because they don't know what you're trying to achieve.
They don't know.
So communication is key. You can't moan or blame people if you haven't given them the information and the knowledge and the reasons behind stuff.
Yeah,
so, yeah, absolutely, it's massive.
Yeah, I think that's a brilliant point. Absolutely brilliant point, and fantastic advice to finish. So, Carl, you know, it just leaves me to say thank you so much for coming on this morning. You know, for anyone listening to this podcast who has a couple of questions, what they've heard today, or just wants to get in contact with you, just to discuss a bit further, what would be the best way to contact you on social media as such?
Probably on my Twitter. So I'm at CarlWild75. So I'm more than happy. I usually try and get some stuff on there. So if people want to follow me on there, that's brilliant. Or if you just want to send me a message through there, I'm more than happy to ask any questions. And just say as well, thank you for having me on. Really enjoyed it. Been a great chat, mate. So listen to you. Other podcasts that have been some really good ones. So I'll carry on listening.
Thank you. No, I appreciate that. And like I say, Carl, a really, really, really good discussion this morning. I think some really great points you've mentioned from your experience. I'm sure a lot of coaches listening to this will, you know, take a lot of that on board. I think with it, you've explained the concepts really well as well. So, yeah, once again, thank you. Thank you so much for your time, Carl. I'm glad you've enjoyed it. And thanks for listening to all of this episodes. And yeah, once again, thanks again to all our listeners. As you know, as always, any questions, please do get in touch, and we'll see everyone next week.